The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre. On Monday, October 28th at 4 p.m., the Economic Development Coalition meeting will be virtual and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For details on how to join the meeting virtually, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Saturday, November 2nd, Ward 7 Councilor Paul Schaefer will host Government Comment Corner in the lobby of the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. You can stop by to say hello and ask questions about your local government. Located at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library, 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue here in Corvallis. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, heard Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m., repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m., and archived at our website, korcfm.com. The following story comes from OregonLive.com, from an article published October 25th, entitled Oregon Department of Corrections Waited 47 Days to Inform Public of Data Breach Involving Hundreds. This is by Noel Crombie of The Oregonian. An Oregon Department of Corrections employee mistakenly emailed out a spreadsheet detailing personal information on nearly 1,000 prison visitors, according to the agency, on Friday. The breach happened over 2 days in August and was discovered by department officials 47 days ago. Governor Tina Kotek's office was informed as soon as the breach was uncovered. The information went to 2 people who were trying to arrange prison visits, according to the department. The staff person sent them a spreadsheet with personal information on 861 people who had completed background checks, which is a requirement for prison visitors. The people who underwent background checks were most likely interested in coming for a prison tour as part of the process to become a volunteer, the agency said on Friday. The information breach included names and driver's license numbers, or state ID numbers, as well as whether the person had passed the background check and dates of birth, the agency said. The state said it worked with the 2 recipients and confirmed that the information was fully deleted from their email systems on September 16th. The department said it is taking steps to limit the likelihood of future errors of this kind. It is also evaluating additional measures to further enhance protocols for the protection of visitors' personal information. Officials said it doesn't appear that individuals' information is at risk, but will make 12 months of identity theft resolution services available to those whose data was breached. The agency said 1 employee was responsible for the breach. They also realized they had shared the spreadsheets with people outside of the agency and reported the breach to their manager. They remain employed with the agency, officials said. That's from an article at OregonLive.com published on October 25th by Noel Crombie. Oregon Department of Corrections waited 47 days to inform public of data breach involving hundreds, is the title. This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Krall.
Greetings, listeners. All right. Welcome to this week's edition of the Corvallis Civics Cafe. This is Wendy Byrne, dishing you information about our city government. In keeping with the metaphor and my intentions, I'm serving you a hearty main course of information flavored with dashes of opinion. This week's entree focuses on the 4 city council incumbents who are running for re-election. I'll share their votes on critical issues during the past 2 years and provide some key statements they made during this year's debate. In addition, I'll give you some updates about what happened in city council meetings this past week. Let's go! This election season, the Corvallis Advocate teamed with City Club of Corvallis to host debates for each of the contested City Council wards. All of the debates have been completed and are posted at the Advocate's website, www.corvallisadvocate.com. and on YouTube at Corvallis Advocate. I've found it useful to watch these debates as the questions are timely and the moderation is effective. Steve Schultz of The Advocate and Helen Higgins of the Corvallis City Club do a good job of keeping the candidates on task, and they move the pace along. Each debate has two sections. The first consists of questions that were provided to the candidates in advance, and the second part is a lightning round of previously unknown questions. The questions are pointed and pertinent and cover topics specific to Corvallis on issues such as housing, houselessness, what might be done about a downtown tax incremental financing district, local economic issues, city infrastructure, city facilities, and the situation with Councillor Charlene Ellis, and more. If you live in Ward 1, 2, 3, 6, 7, or 9, your time would be well spent watching your ward's candidates debate. If you are unsure about your ward, type Wards of Corvallis into an online search engine, or find the candidates listed on your ballot. The Advocate published their endorsements on Friday, October 25th, and it's a good read. Go check it out at corvallisadvocate.com. If you live in Wards 1, 2, 7, or 9, your city councilor is running for re-election and has competition from a newcomer. While I cannot tell you how the challenger might vote, I can tell you how your current councillor has voted over the past 2 years, as that information is in the public record. On many issues, the Corvallis City Council reaches consensus, and most votes end up being unanimous. That makes split votes fairly interesting. For example, I can tell you that on August 21st of 2023, when presented with the option of voting to make efforts to include all council members in a meeting about team building, Councillors Napak and Kadena voted against it, and Councillors Lewis and Schaefer voted for it. On January 2nd of this year, when voting to move forward with asking voters to change council terms from 2 to 4 years, the only councillors that voted yes were Napak and Kadena. During the same January 2nd meeting, Councillor Gabe Shepherd presented a motion to create a threshold of votes needed to expel a councillor from office, which Councillors Lewis and Schaefer supported, but Councillors Napak and Kadena opposed. On June 10th of 2023, and again in August of 2024, Ward 1's Jan Napak voted against supporting ranked choice voting for our state elections, while Councillors Kadena, Lewis, and Schaefer supported it. And more recently, regarding the Marriott Hotel parking lot decision, Councillors Napak and Kadena both voted in support of the parking lot, while Lewis and Schaefer voted against it. To me, of all of those votes, perhaps the most interesting and telling one was the vote that happened on August 21st, 2023. During that meeting, as they were discussing the plan to schedule a facilitated meeting focusing on teamwork, Councillor Ellis made a motion asking staff to find a time that would allow all the councillors to attend the training. The only two dissenting votes were Napak and Kadena. And about that Councillor Ellis situation, during the debates, in the lightning round of questions, each candidate was asked quite pointedly if the Charlene Ellis matter has been a good use of city resources and time. Considering that each of the incumbents has been in office throughout the duration of this situation, their answers were illuminating. Ward 7's Paul Schaefer stated, quote, "I can't say a whole lot about it in case it comes in front of the council," unquote, but he did note that he voted against hiring an outside attorney for the case, and when pressed to answer the question about good use of time, he plainly stated no. Ward 2's Bria Lewis stated, quote, "Whatever happens, happens," unquote, and when she was pressed to give an answer, stated, quote, "Personally, no," unquote. Ward 9's Tony Kadena equivocated, stating, quote, "yes, no, and maybe," unquote. More descriptively, he said, "no, because I think it could have been avoided. Yes, because we have a fiduciary responsibility to respond and defend a lawsuit when the city is being sued. And maybe, because if we can reach greater clarity around rules and responsibilities, and perhaps pursue alternate dispute resolution, then perhaps a good outcome could still come from this." You might notice that he never actually answered the question. Ward 1's Jan Napak gave the most valiant of efforts to avoid directly answering the question, initially wandering off topic to discuss the city charter, then stating that she should not address the question due to the status of the litigation. Eventually, she agreed that there were other ways to deal with the matter, but reminded the listeners that the city had been sued and needed to respond. Never mind that Ellis would never have sued the city if she had not felt her civil rights were violated. To go a bit deeper on the subject of Ellis versus the city of Corvallis, not a single one of the candidates for council, incumbent or otherwise, opined that this has been a good use of city time or resources, but none of the current members of the council seem to be willing or able to stop it. In other city government news this week... Just kidding! Meeting highlights from the October 21st meeting of City Council include the presentation of the annual City of Corvallis Sustainability Report, the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force findings and final report, and the discussion of moving forward with the $35 million full faith and credit bond to fund design and construction of a new parks maintenance building in Avery Park. There was also a large crowd in the audience demonstrating support for a tax incremental financing district for downtown. That support aligns with some of the recommendations from the Civic Engagement Task Force. Other points of interest from the task force's report include keeping the current City Hall building intact for use as meeting rooms, building a new city administrative building on city property downtown at 5th and Madison, decoupling a new police department building from the Civic Campus project, and respecting the strong feedback received from the community regarding keeping City Hall and city services downtown, as well as respecting our concerns about how to pay for these things. The full report can be found on the city website at corvallisoregon.gov. Followers of improvements for active transportation will be happy to know that the City Council unanimously supported city staff moving forward with text amendments to the Comprehensive Plan and the Land Development Code to incorporate the Southwest West Hills Corridor Plan into our transportation system plan. This will be great news for biking and walking along West Hills Boulevard when future development happens out at the Marys River Annexation area. And on Thursday of last week, the City Council participated in the final work session on their update of the city's strategic operational plan, where they are striving to separate the operations from the strategic plan so that the plan can focus on the policy priorities of the council. After considerable discussion and editing, their work on the plan is complete, and city staff will incorporate the changes into a new strategic plan and present it to the council and the public at their Monday night meeting on December 2nd. So that is the news about city government in Corvallis this week. For those of you that are contemplating your votes, November 5th is right around the corner, but there is still time to inform yourself about the city council candidates and make a good choice for someone you feel will best represent your interests in your ward. The national political scene makes me anxious, but the local scene promises positive change, and I am excited that there will be several fresh faces coming to the council in 2025. I hope you share my interest. It is your voice. It is your choice. Please vote. Thanks for joining me here at the Corvallis Civics Cafe. If you have comments or feedback, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. If you have feedback for KORC's News, Music, and Civics program, email us at news@korcfm.com. Until next time, this is Wendy Byrne for KORC.
Hi everyone, this is Lava Lamp Larry, continuing my report on two more measures on your 2024 ballot, Measure 118 and Measure 119. You, the voter, will decide in November, get those ballots in by November 5th, whether to approve Measure 118, which proponents say would give about $1,600 annually to all Oregonians by making corporations pay more. Opponents across the political spectrum, citing analysis from state economic researchers, warned that it would raise prices and blow a hole in the state's budget. At least four progressive organizations that previously backed Measure 118, the measure to hike taxes on businesses, have withdrawn their support. The measure, largely funded by wealthy Californians, earlier this month trumpeted endorsements from the Community Alliance of Tenants and Portland Tenants United, bringing its total number of endorsements to 9, but it counted endorsements from 11 groups in July, an archived version of the measure's website shows. 4 progressive groups, the Oregon Working Families Party, the Farm Workers Union, PCUN, Democratic Socialists of Eugene and Laborers Local 483 quietly walked back their support in the past few months. The measure retained support from some other progressive organizations, including the Oregon Progressive Party, the Pacific Green Party, and the Oregon Chapter of Progressive Democrats of America. Antonio Gisbert, chief petitioner for Measure 118, dismissed the organizations that withdrew their endorsements as not being brave enough to buck politicians, he says, are obliged to corporate donors. It's no surprise to us that some organizations felt pressure to walk back support once elected officials began a concerted effort to denounce Measure 118 in favor of their corporate donors, Gisbert said. This is sadly how Salem works. Nothing has changed in the content of the ballot measure nor in the reasoning for their initial endorsements. We know that political change requires significant courage, which is why we are proud and encouraged by all the support Measure 118 has received. Annie Naranjo Rivera, state director of the Working Families Party, told the Capital Chronicle that the party still supports a wealth tax, but that Measure 118 had too many problems. She says, "We were looking forward to supporting a measure that funds the care, support, and services our families need by making big corporations pay what they owe. It's one of the backbones of the Working Family Party's legislature agenda," Naranjo Rivera said. "But this measure has flaws, and it would potentially take resources from our communities and harm our families' economic well-being." The Working Families Party now has a neutral stance on Measure 118, neither endorsing it nor joining the large coalition opposing it. Representatives of the three other former endorsers did not return phone calls or emails on Monday. The Oregon Laborers International Union of North America, or LIUNA, now opposes only Measure 118 on its list of 2024 endorsements. The campaign arm of PCUN left Measure 118 off its endorsement list while it's supporting other ballot measures. A political action committee organized by Oregon Business and Industry has raised more than $15 million to defeat the measure, with more than $1.8 million from a political action committee funded by grocers and hundreds of thousands from other Oregon businesses. Our Oregon, a coalition of unions, environmental groups, and civil rights groups, also has two PAC committees that oppose the measure. Let's take a look now at Oregon Measure 119, the Unionization of Cannabis Workers Initiative. It's on the ballot in Oregon as an initiated state statute for the upcoming November election. A yes vote supports requiring cannabis businesses to submit to the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission a signed labor peace agreement requiring the business to remain neutral when labor organizations communicate with employees about collective bargaining rights with its licensure or renewal application. A no vote on 119 opposes requiring cannabis businesses to submit to the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission a signed labor peace agreement. Let's take a look at that. A signed labor peace agreement is defined in the statute as an agreement by which an applicant or licensee agrees to remain neutral with respect to the labor organization's representatives communicating with the employees of the applicant or the licensee about the employee's rights. If an applicant or licensee does not submit a signed labor peace agreement or abide by the terms of the agreement, Measure 119 authorizes the commission to deny the application for license. If a labor peace agreement is terminated for any reason, the licensee would be required to notify the commission of its termination within 10 business days and to enter into a new labor peace agreement within 30 days of termination. So I say to all of you, let's have labor peace. Well, that's your rundown for those two initiatives, Measures 118 and 119. Get out there and vote. You've got till November 5th. For KORC News, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
Like a fly on the wall, at my own funeral, I am free. Like a fly on the wall, at my own funeral, I am free. Like a fly on the wall, at my own funeral, I am free.
The University of Oregon has digitized and uploaded scans of historic newspapers from our region, dating back to the mid-19th century. These are available from the UFO Library's website and are in the public domain. As these documents record the views and events of an active settler colonial society during a time of indigenous displacement and cultural genocide, some of the material here is strange, shocking, and rightly detestable. Some information may also reveal admirable qualities of people in the past. Still, don't forget that the true complexity of human lifeways is not recorded in newspapers, books, or even oral histories. Humans are always liable to erase, distort, and embellish information to reinforce their worldview. In the context of history, our ancestors and predecessors can be thought of as a foreign culture to us, embodying a different economic, technological, and social reality. From the comfort of the present, we can look with a curious eye back to the things we were right to outgrow, the things we still carry with us, and the things we wish we hadn't lost and may remember again. According to David Fagan's History of Benton County, the Corvallis Gazette was started in 1863 as a vigorously partisan supporter of the then new Republican Party, and was a leading voice in the temperance movement against the consumption of alcohol. In 1876, the Gazette was made into a corporation, a reflection of the far-flung moneyed interests fueling the nascent media industry of westward migration. Here are some excerpts from the Corvallis Gazette from October 11th, 1879. The heaviest blow ever dealt at the business interests of Lane County, and one from which the citizen of that county will not soon recover, was the fire which laid in ashes a whole block, excepting Gilmore's Hotel, in Junction City, on the 7th. The fire, supposed to be the work of an incendiary, was first noticed about 1 o'clock by parties who were in Craig's Saloon and originated in the back part of B. Cohen's store about 70 feet back from Front Street. Before the alarm could be given, the fire had passed beyond control and the flames were shooting up the side of the building and through the roof as if the walls had been saturated with coal oil. The city was without fire engines, and every man, woman, and child fought bravely to subdue the flames. The total loss is estimated at $55,375, against which there is not to exceed $18,000 insurance. Several persons were arrested for setting fire to B. Cohen's building, but the evidence seemed to be insufficient to fasten the guilt upon any one. From the Salem Record, we learn that on Thursday afternoon of last week, Mr. Schertz, son-in-law of James Bruce of Benton County, who lives in eastern Oregon, was on his road with his wife and infant child to pay a visit to his wife's people in Benton County, and while fording the Santee Am near Sweet Home as they reached the middle of the stream, one of the horses balked and refused to go further. A boat was brought to take the occupants to the shore, but the parties having the boat, in their excitement, went to the side and drifting against the wagon caused it to upset, drowning Mrs. Schertz and her infant child. The body of Mrs. Schertz has been recovered, but that of the child had not at last accounts. Of course, we sincerely sympathize with the bereaved husband and suppose he knew where he was from and where he was going. But upon diligent inquiry, we failed to place Mr. James Bruce in Benton County. We knew a James Bruce, more familiarly known as Major Bruce, who formerly resided in this county and now a resident of Washington County, but was not apprised of his having a son-in-law. A prominent politician suggests that Mr. James Bruce may have come to the county since the election. One day last week, a young lady in this city was cleaning up her pistol. A bystander asked the question, "What are you doing with that pistol? You can't shoot." At this, the young would-be sportswoman leveled her pistol in the direction of a window and pulled the trigger, and to her astonishment, the pistol was discharged, the ball passing through the window and into the door of a china house in close proximity. But luckily, the Chinaman that might have been accidentally standing in the range of the pistol was somewhere else. The fortunate Chinaman, on hearing the report of the pistol, poked his head out of the door and asked the young lady, "What for you shoot?" To which the young lady replied, "Me shoot 'em cats. You no tell Rayburn." Such careless use of firearms in the hands of inexperienced females, especially when they have not sufficient knowledge to tell whether the weapon is loaded or empty, should be made reprehensible in the extreme, and no person's life is secure. We have omitted names, hoping that a lesson may be learned from this narrow escape of being a murderess. 2 weeks ago, a correspondent to the Benton Democrat noticed the fact that the Oregon legislature had ordered the saloon removed from the Capitol, and then proceeded to contend that the whiskey was removed because the legislature was Democratic. That had the political complexion of that body been different, the action would have been different. Well, it may be the case, at all events, we hope so, for the credit of the Republicans, for the Democrats have made a terrible botch of it. When the resolution passed, the press praised the action. Temperance people thought, at least, our lawmakers had taken a step in the right direction. The proper officers were ordered to remove the saloon from the building, and with a flourish of trumpets, the world is informed that it has been done. But still, the Democratic members of the legislature procure their whiskey straight at the same place for 10 cents a drink. There is still a saloon in full blast in Oregon's Capitol building. Shame! Where are thy blushes? Mr. W.B. Carter returned home on Thursday of last week in very feeble health, having taken cold on his way down on Monday previous. He was able, however, to return to Salem on Monday morning. The state fair commenced yesterday at Salem. The skating rink at City Hall has commenced again for the winter. Thomas Russell, Esquire, of the Lower Alsea, was in town the first of the week. He reports everything in that portion of the county in a state of peace, plenty, and content. The Senate bill, introduced by Mr. Palmer of this county, extending the time for the completion of the WVC Railroad, passed the Senate last Tuesday. This bill provides for extending the time for completing the Yaquina Railroad for 6 years from the time the bill becomes a law. Under the charter as it now stands, the company would have to complete the road to Tidewater on the Yaquina Bay within 1 year from this month. Yesterday morning, October 10, 1878, at 9 o'clock, Mr. E.E. Cooper of Tacoma, Washington, and Miss Fanny B. Hamilton of this city were united in marriage by Reverend H.P. Dunning. This was an unexpected event, even to the most intimate friends of the parties. Miss Hamilton had long been one of the favorites of Corvallis Society, and we note the fact of her marriage with some regret from the fact that she left the city the same morning for her future home in Tacoma. However, all our selfish feelings give way to the hope that her life may be one of unclouded happiness. Uncle Davy Newsome is confined to his bed most of the time with severe sickness of a complicated character. Mrs. Kaufman, aged 61 years, living near New Era, was recently kicked by a cow, breaking her leg between the knee and ankle. Tommy, a 10-year-old son of Gold Hubbard, living near Dallas, had his jawbone broke on Wednesday of last week by being kicked by a horse. While the steamer Ohio was going down from Dayton on the 4th and was passing Clackamas Rapids, she struck a rock and immediately sank. From the Portland Bee, we learn that Archie Brown, the murderer of young Joseph, has received a letter from his mother, in which she disowns him and leaves him to the mercy of outraged law. There is considerable emotion among the Umatilla Indians on account of one of their number being killed on Wild Horse Creek, and fears are entertained among the whites that Indians will retaliate. Recently, while the editor of the Roseburg Plain Dealer was surveying in the mountains west of that city, he found, just below the falls of Lake Creek, an old campfire in the ashes of which were a number of human bones. It is supposed that the remains were those of a detective by the name of Coyote, who had been employed to apprehend and arrest a man by the name of Green, and that Green, becoming cognizant of that fact, murdered Coyote and attempted to obliterate all traces by burning the body. Green is now in the penitentiary for life for murdering a man in California.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. This is JC, and I had the opportunity recently to speak with Rick Stagenborg, the president of the Linus Pauling Chapter for Veterans for Peace, who has some updates about Palestinian solidarity, how individuals can make a difference in our community, and just some updates about what is going on between Israel and Palestine. So, Rick, for our listeners, because you're so knowledgeable about all these activities and the events that are going on, what are the Palestinians doing while Israel's bombing these other countries as well?
Well, they're still resisting. Israel has just it's genocidal. It has been from the beginning, but it's getting actually, if you could imagine, worse. I mean, they ordered the entire population of northern Gaza to leave, and they gave them 24 hours at one point. And
The people in Gaza 24 right. hours to leave.
Northern Gaza.
Yeah. Northern, okay.
They told them to go south. Well, as always before, they're attacking the people that are leaving, and in fact, it's even worse now. They've got roadblocks set up. They're shooting people that were, within that first 24 hours when they try to leave buildings. They've been all throughout Palestine. They've been shooting children in the head for sport. Their doctors and nurses, a whole collection of them, have given eyewitness reports to the New York Times. And, it's really disgusting, and yet it doesn't seem to change the attitude of Americans. The majority of Americans, significant majority, want a ceasefire. Not all of them really see it as a one-sided thing. They just realize, oh my God, this killing is crazy. And now, with Israel attacking Lebanon and doing the same thing there, at least in terms of their bombing, and seemingly trying to start a war with Iran. I mean, killing Iranians in Beirut, Iranian officials, killing the chief negotiator. They're trying to start a war so that the United States will feel obligated to step in, because Iran has the capability of devastating. It could easily devastate Israel if it just let everything go. Hezbollah could inflict severe damage on Israel if they let everything go. They got hypersonic missiles. Iran has hypersonic missiles. Even Yemen has hypersonic missiles. It's insane, but
so
they...
So do you know why Israel is poking the bear, so to speak? Why
they're doing this? To get the U.S. to join, right.
So they're doing this. So they're spreading the hate, as we'll say.
The violence.
The violence, mm-hmm. in order for the United States to... Have we sent troops there? I read somewhere.
We undoubtedly had some troops there already, special forces, and worthy. Recently they sent 100 troops to operate a THAAD missile defense system. That's how many it takes to operate a battery. So that's what they're there for, but that makes them a target. So we basically sent some, that could be a tripwire to start a war. could be an excuse for Americans to get more involved.
Why did President Biden send in troops to Israel? What was...
Well, I mean, I could read everything he says, but that's not as helpful as seeing what he does.
Right.
It was recently revealed that they never wanted to deal with Hamas. Well, they say Hamas is in charge. Who are they going to deal with? So the latest, they've been a little more explicit lately in what they're actually talking to Saudi Arabia about having Saudi Arabian or a mixture of other troops come in and occupy Palestine. But, you know, it's not pacified yet. They'll fight anybody that comes there and tries to control. I can't imagine that Saudi Arabia would go for it because their people, less Saudi Arabia, more Egypt, but to some extent Saudi Arabia, the people on the street, they don't want the government to support Israel. There will be potentially consequences. It's pretty hard to start a revolution in Saudi Arabia. They're so extremely repressive. But also, you know, Bin Salman is trying to project a new image. You know, he's not murdering journalists in New York anymore, supposedly, and things like that. He stopped the war on Yemen, sort of, in a way, after, you know, securing control of some of their oil production.
In other words, what's happening is that there's an escalation of violence and conflict.
Right.
Which was started basically by Israel, correct?
Well, I mean, just to be fair, Hezbollah has been lobbing missiles in various kinds of armaments they've been using to attack Israel in the north and drive out the settlers there ever since October 8th, because they knew what Hamas was trying to do by launching an attack. And they were going to defend them because they knew there'd be a horrific response in defense of Palestine. We knew what was going to happen. Israel always, you know, overreacts. Their whole doctrine of defense is to respond with overwhelming force to any resistance. Israel is illegally occupying the occupied territories, especially the West Bank and Gaza, also East Jerusalem, and they just keep pushing. They've also increased the violence in the West Bank before October 7th. They were clearly accelerating their violence. They were getting more violent. They were accelerating the rate of settlement. And that was under Biden, so it didn't matter who won the election as far as that goes, because Trump was cheering the expansion of the settlements and saying it's a good thing.
So since October 7th, it almost gave them carte blanche, Israel, to continue accelerate their killing of Palestinians,
well,
basically.
You know, I saw an interview with a former Mossad agent who said that, you know, there was no way they could. At first, the government was saying they didn't know. And then it was later shown that they knew.
So, Rick, you said that these other countries could devastate Israel if they wanted to. What is stopping them? What is keeping them restrained?
Well, the main thing that's keeping them restrained is the fact that Israel has nuclear missiles. And they have, it's estimated, at least 200 nuclear weapons that could destroy all these countries or cause severe damage, let's say.
Okay.
Now, I don't think even Israel wants to do that, but who knows what they'll do if they feel like they're existentially threatened. And if all of these countries unload all the weapons they have at once, or they would be existentially threatened. Hypersonic missiles, a lot of missiles are hypersonic, but they call hypersonic missiles for shorthand, is missiles that go at many, many times the speed of sound. They move so fast that the United States is not sure if the new defense system, the THAAD system that they put in there, can stop it. So, you know, they just put 100 troops in there. If Iran gets attacked and decides as part of its response to take out that THAAD missile defense, there go 100 Americans, and that's America's excuse. That's the United States' excuse to get in, if that's their goal. If they want to say, well, now we don't have any choice. We've just been giving them weapons and let them do the genocide while we whine about it. you know, as if there's nothing the president can do all by himself without Congress. They just, you know, oh, too bad all this violence is going. We're trying for a ceasefire. Now we find out that neither Israel, Israel doesn't want a ceasefire, and Hamas doesn't want a ceasefire under Israel's conditions. So then they're saying, oh, neither side wants a ceasefire. Nonsense. Hamas has been calling for a ceasefire from the beginning, practically. And Israel has, you know, set certain conditions. Hamas has even agreed to those as far back as last July, I think it was. And Israel changed the conditions. Their plan is to ethnically cleanse Palestine. So, you know, in 67, they were responding to a provocation in the Sinai Desert that they kind of, it was a Nasser. Thought he could get away with driving Israeli troops back from where they'd gone from the last conflict. And instead, it was a trap. Israel was planning on using that to take the whole Sinai and the Golan Heights, Syria, and the West Bank. This was all planned out in advance. And they did. They took all of that. The story since then, that was 1967, the story since then is about them gaining control of the rest of it, consolidating that control, and driving out the Palestinians systematically through settlements, through cruelty, through destroying their access to their own farms, whatever they can do to make things unlivable. They've been doing it since 67. It's just that now this is the end. They're going to complete the job. Increased rate of settlement and this increased rate of murders by the Israeli occupation force in the territories, because they have no right to be there. That's not defense. It's not defense when you're occupying the territories. They have a right to resist, especially when you're moving in settlers, which is illegal under the Geneva Convention.
So we know that that's not defense. Do they care what happens to the Palestinians in terms of where they go?
Well, let's be careful when we say they. You know, there's the Israeli government, there's the Israeli people. We would like to believe that the Israeli people would prefer some other way of doing this. But if you look at polls, most of them, a great majority of them, are okay with the war and the way it's being conducted. And some of those who aren't okay with it think they've been too gentle. They haven't used enough violence. They're scared, okay, they're terrified. But some of them are actually trying to get through the gates to occupy Gaza already. They were doing that months ago.
So there is a group of people, like you mentioned, the Mid-Willamette Valley Jews for Peace.
Absolutely.
There's another Jewish group that you mentioned for peace.
Jewish Voices for Peace, that's a national.
Voice for Peace.
Right.
So there are Jewish groups. And I'm sure as well in Israel, who are against what is happening to the Palestinians.
There are still some. And then there's varying degrees of opposition. There was a substantial movement at one time against, maintaining the occupation back in the 70s.
So, Rick, how can citizens in Corvallis and Albany get more involved? What are some things they can do to affect some change so that we can help the Palestinian people?
Well, I think maybe the first thing that people need to do is let go of the idea that if what you do doesn't have an immediate effect, that it isn't worth doing. If they understand what a grassroots movement is, okay, let go of the attitude you don't make a difference. When 300 million people say that, they're right. If 20,000 people said no, well, you'd have a fraction of the movement. If 20,000 people in Corvallis said no, imagine. But it doesn't have to be that many, and it isn't going to happen overnight. It grows when you're showing up. Now, what the other major thing, once you've let go of those attitudes, realize this is going to last a long time. Because when the bombs stop, the genocide won't. People still starve to death. They'll die of diseases that could have been treated, but the Israelis are not allowing what medicine's in. There will be many, many more deaths. That's why that Lancet letter to the editor estimated very conservatively several months ago that at least 186,000 people were going to die. Then they destroyed the medical system and they couldn't count them anymore. And it's never going to stop until we force Israel to stop by telling them they're not going to get any more weapons to expand this war, to commit genocide, to commit ethnic cleansing. These are crimes against humanity, as is apartheid, and Israel is no doubt an apartheid society.
That was Rick Stagenborg, the president of the Linus Pauling chapter of Veterans for Peace, talking about Palestinian solidarity. If you'd like more information on what you can do to support the pro-Palestinian movement, go to the Palestine Solidarity Campaign at palestinecampaign.org. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
Hi, neighbors. This is Claire Gilgannon, here to talk with you about turkey vultures. Yes, folks, you heard me correctly. I said turkey vultures. Those wonderful darlings of decay we often see soaring on thermals above our neighborhoods or in the wide open spaces of agricultural grasslands and riparian zones. Did you know that turkey vultures consume, nearly exclusively, the dead and decaying flesh of animals killed by disease, roadside collision, or natural causes? Yes, absolutely metal as fuck, I know. They lack the strength in their talons to grasp and kill live prey, so instead use their keen sense of sight and smell to locate their dead meals. By consuming decaying flesh, turkey vultures provide a key ecosystem service to all of us. Not only do they remove what would otherwise be left to rot, turkey vultures are also immune to many communicable diseases, including the rabies virus, which can infect pets, livestock, and humans, and is always fatal if left untreated. Turkey vultures don't give a fuck. They digest it and then even regurgitate it for their babies. And a turkey vulture that consumes infected meat effectively removes it from the environment, thereby reducing the presence of diseases that could otherwise harm us. So give them a break. Take a moment to appreciate the next turkey vulture you spot. And if you see a turkey vulture feasting on a carcass alongside a road or highway, give them space. Change lanes if it's safe to do so, or slow down to reduce the chance the birds will attempt to take flight. Collision with vehicles injures and kills thousands of turkey vultures each year, and we need them around. Understand and respect their place in the ecosystem. You are listening to KORC.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, heard Sundays from 1 to 2, repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. on KORC. This is Dan Kroll. I am here in the Southtown studio, and I am joined by Jim Moorfield, who is running for City Council in Ward 3. We like to give equal time to everyone who's running for council in this upcoming election, which you should have your ballot all ready to fill out. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Yes, my name is Jim, and Ward 3, the ward I'm running in, is really South Corvallis, most of South Corvallis, in case anyone doesn't know the boundaries.
I just assume I live in Ward 3 here in Southeast Corvallis.
There's also Ward 2 also includes downtown and some areas around campus, but also includes a corner of South Corvallis. So those are the two wards that represent our interest here in Southtown. Tell you a little bit about my experience, which does inform why I'm running for city council. First of all, my wife and I have lived in the same home on Richland for 41 years, over 41 years now. We raised our kids here. We greet our grandchildren when they visit here. And this has been a neighborhood that is really, we've really loved it. And we're going to spend the rest of our lives here. Professionally, I've worked in human services and affordable housing way back in the 1980s for people that our longtime residents of Corvallis, you might remember a place called Sunflower House. And I worked there for most of the 80s. In the 90s, I worked at Community Services Consortium and worked on matters including homelessness and other anti-poverty work. And then finally, in 1998, I was hired as executive director of Willamette Neighborhood Housing Services. That is a nonprofit that develops affordable housing in a whole region in the Willamette Valley. I did that for 20 years until I retired in 2018. So I have experience in human services, homelessness, mental health, and affordable housing. I'd like to do more to address three things. One is that we have a South Corvallis Urban Renewal Plan that was adopted by voters a few years ago. Almost 85% of the voters said yes to that plan. That was a strong measure of support for South Corvallis. And then the pandemic hit and a lot of things got stalled, and it's time to redouble our efforts to achieve some of the goals of that plan. Secondly, climate change. You know, I became a granddad a few years ago, and I always cared about climate change, but boy, when I started seeing the little kids that are part of my family and imagined their future, I knew that it was time to do something about that more aggressively. The city does have a climate action plan that a committee and the council and staff have been working on. There's more to do there. I also think that all the usual planning we do, whether it's land use planning, transportation, infrastructure, and so on, we have to undertake that planning with an eye towards the future and what a resilient community needs and what it's going to look like when we have a lot more people who are climate refugees moving to Oregon. And then thirdly, I want to do more to address homelessness. I have experience with that professionally. Back when I worked at Sunflower House, we opened the first men's shelter in Corvallis, and we worked with street people every day. We have a number of plans over the years to address homelessness, but there's something that none of those plans actually say, and that is all the partners working on the problem are going to work towards one end, and that is to end homelessness. It kind of still blows my mind that we don't have an agreement among all the partners that says this is how we're going to end homelessness, this is what we're going to do, this is what needs to improve. Addressing homelessness requires three things: available housing, a way to pay the rent, and supportive services. People who are chronically homeless are the people that we see in our streets. Chronic homelessness is defined as being homeless for at least 1 year or repeatedly homeless, and that the person has a disability. One of the solutions to address the needs of those folks is being undertaken by Corvallis Housing First. Down on 3rd Street, the former Budget Inn, which then became a shelter during the pandemic, and now is getting ready to be torn down and to have 46 or 47, I don't remember which, 40-something units of affordable housing for people who are chronically homeless. There's a significant population of older people who are homeless, chronically homeless. Something like 26%, I believe, of all the people that were counted last January were homeless are over 55. And people who have lived on the streets often for decades and have a disability and don't always know where they're going to be the next night or where the food's going to come from, they need permanent housing. This population needs more one-bedroom and studio apartments. That's something that Corvallis has a severe shortage of, but we can develop more of those kinds of units. Ways to pay the rent, there's existing programs. Some can be targeted more effectively, especially the Section 8 assistance program run by the Lynn Benton Housing Authority. And then when it comes to supportive services, there's a lot of partners in that, nonprofits, public agencies. And then the city of Corvallis. The city of Corvallis is not a housing developer. The city is not a provider of social services. But the city does help finance affordable housing projects, and it does help provide funding for social services. So I would like to see the city's efforts become more targeted. But beyond that, there's a lot of other partners that provide the services people need. The one thing that is lacking, as I said earlier, is that we don't have a plan for how all of the partners are actually going to end homelessness, that sets measurable goals and then identifies exactly what everyone's going to do to address the problem.
We're speaking with Jim Moorfield. He is running for Ward 3, City Council, here in Southeast Corvallis. If listeners want to learn more about your platform, is there a website or any kind of web presence that you have?
I've been running a real low-key campaign, as is my co-candidate, Mark Territute. And so I haven't raised any money. We don't have yard signs. We're mostly just having community meetings. We do have a presence in South Corvallis Google group and on Nextdoor. I've posted information about myself in both places, as has Mark.
Well, as KORC's effort is to give every city council hopeful equal time to come on these airwaves and present your case, we'd like to thank you for your time on KORC News, Music, and Civics. Please say your name again and the ward you are running for.
I'm Jim Moorfield, and I'm running for the Corvallis City Council representing Ward 3.
This is Wendy Byrne bringing you details about your local government for KORC News, Music, and Civics. KORC strives to provide information from the City Council and other City of Corvallis boards and commissions during our news show. It is important for area residents to be involved in local government, and we understand that busy work and life schedules make that challenging. KORC News, Music, and Civics is here to help. Were you aware that Corvallis City Government follows specific state rules regarding city meetings? This includes providing public notice about meetings and allowing both live and remote attendance during meetings. Interested people can view meeting materials before or during the meetings, and these materials are archived after each meeting. More information can be found on the city's website at archives.corvallisoregon.gov. To make it easier to keep track of meeting dates and times, you can sign up to receive email notifications about various city meetings. Email notifications include details about the dates, times of the meetings, as well as links to the meeting materials. Sign up for notifications by going to the city website, corvallisoregon.gov. Once you are there, scroll down and find the e-notifications tab on the right-hand side of the page. This will take you to corvallisoregon.gov/subscribe. On this page of the website, you will see a comprehensive list of all the various advisory boards, commissions, task forces, and other meetings of the city that might interest you, and you can subscribe to receive email notifications about any of them. Once subscribed, you will receive email notices before the meetings and links to the recordings of the meetings when they become available. City of Corvallis meeting recordings are archived by chronological order on Vimeo. You can create a Vimeo account for free and use it to view these archives at vimeo.com/cityofcorvallis. For KORC, this has been Wendy Byrne. You can hear KORC News, Music, and Civics every Sunday at 1 p.m., repeated Mondays at 5 p.m., and archived at korcfm.com.
Environmentalists and Popular Mechanics magazine agree. Leaving the vehicle idling is a lose-lose. The long-held notion that you should let your car idle in the cold is only true for carbureted engines. Unlike the old days, most modern engines are warmed up in under 20 seconds. Stagnant air is common in the Willamette Valley, and when you consider the cost of gas, the fact that many sources of air pollution already exist, and we have limited resources with a growing global population, it just makes sense to be mindful and efficient. Nobody's asking you to be perfect. Just be aware of these things. If you're planning on stopping your vehicle for more than 20 seconds, it's a good idea to turn off the engine. Save some money, preserve the long-term life and health of your engine, and keep the air clean for all of us. We're in this together. This message has been brought to you by KORC.